As a result, he could only achieve a poor imitation of the sage's behavior because he had not done the necessary groundwork. For this reason, the rationalist, puritanical mind is a veneer above a muck heap, an attempt to copy greatness by wearing its clothes. But when psychologists began to have the idea of the unconscious, this was simply man's fumbling rediscovery of the lost gods and demons. Naturally, experienced occultists of both East and West were inclined to smile. For them, this new force, called the unconscious, had never existed as such. And when people started talking about the unconscious as if it were just a repository of repressed sexuality, the occultists laughed outright, knowing that it contained far more powerful divinities than libido, who was just a little imp dancing upon the surface. It must have seemed funnier still to hear the unconscious discussed as if it were a sort of individual with secret dark designs and an unfortunate habit of wanting and thinking in direct opposition to the conscious. For the unconscious is not an individual. It is simply that about himself which man does not know. As such, it is a purely relative term, because some people know more about themselves than others. Symbolically, it may be represented as an individual, for in dreams the unknown aspect of men presents itself as a woman, and vice versa with women. But actually, when it is said that the unconscious does this or that, it means that certain particular aspects of your internal universe are on the move, without your conscious knowledge. The concept of the unconscious is nevertheless important to modern students of religion and occultism, in that it is a reminder of the forgotten gods, and of the place where they are to be found. Too many would-be mystics and occultists try to follow the rationalist technique of imposing a discipline upon themselves without first understanding the nature of the thing to be disciplined. You have to come to terms with the gods before you can ignore them. And those who jump straight from ordinary ways of living into the complex disciplines of occultism are inviting trouble. For until those terms have been made, the gods rule us, although we have a way of persuading ourselves that their often unreasonable dictates are our own free and considered choice. Thus, imitation of the sage is often a device put up by the demons for our own destruction. For modern man simply does not realize that until he has been through the valley of the shadow, his life is not his own. Until he looks within himself, seeks out his hidden pantheon, and overcomes it by love, or what psychologists call acceptance, he remains its unwitting tool. In all the old philosophies, yoga, Buddhism, the Greek mysteries, the Egyptian mysteries, this exploring of the unknown self was the essential first step. And now the same thing is attempted by the psychoanalyst, using a different technique and terminology. That there are failures and mistakes is only to be expected, for here are men trying to work out the divine science on their own, with little recourse to the experience of the ages, though to this there are a few notable exceptions. And though students of religion may be offended when religion is ascribed to repressed sexuality, it must be remembered that in many cases, this may actually be true. And that psychologists have had insufficient opportunities to study that comparatively rare phenomenon, the genuine mystic or occultist. For what would such a person want with psychoanalysis? The warning to the beginner, however, still stands. For unless you really know yourself, how can you say that your apparently noble aspirations are what they seem to be? Thoughts are often wolves in sheep's clothing. Then, is the first step on the path a visit to the psychoanalyst? Unfortunately, the matter is not quite so easy. If you can find a competent analyst, perhaps. But the profession of analyst attracts many who need their own medicine more than any of their patients. The reason is that psychoanalysis has not yet had sufficient profundity of experience to judge its own results. To institute a hierarchy of initiates who can be trusted to say who is and is not fit to take up the profession. There is another alternative. Though the professional analyst usually regards it with horror, that is, to analyze yourself. It needs care and a pair of feet planted firmly on the earth. But if due regard is paid to the rules, it can be done. You can follow the age-old techniques of meditation, and you will often be safer in your own hands than in those of your analyst. Of course, it is risky, but in these days, so many people expect a safe way to wisdom. The way to wisdom is, however, a great deal less safe than the way to making a fortune. It is perhaps the riskiest and most worthwhile thing in the world. But you should not start out on it unless you are prepared to break your neck. That far-off divine event. What is the that Tennyson described as that far-off divine event to which all creation moves? In mystical and occult philosophy, it is the return of all individual things to the divine source from which they originally came. An event which Hindu cosmology places at the end of a stupendous period of time called Mahamanvantara, or a great manifestation of Brahman. For according to Hindu and theosophical teachings, universal activity is a succession of the days and nights of Brahman. The outbreathings and the inbreathings of the one reality of life, whose name is derived from the Sanskrit bri, from which our own word breathe is also descended. Modern science has now begun to think of time in somewhat the same terms as the ancient Hindus, for they measured these days and nights of Brahman by groups of kalpas, a kalpa being a mere 4,320,000,000 years. Now, if these things are true, the ordinary man or woman has to accept them rather much on faith. And because it is difficult, if not impossible, for ordinary people to test their verity, and because the periods of time involved are past imagining, it will be asked whether such ideas are of the remotest practical value. For the events of which we are speaking are certainly divine and undoubtedly far off. And it may seem that the ancient Hindus were indulging in idle speculations for want of anything better to do. For us, the difficulty of this Hindu conception of the far-off divine event, when all things shall again become one with Brahman, is that, taken at its face value, it makes the soul despair. For not only does so terrifying a period of time lie between now and the final resting of the universe in divine bliss, but the doctrine also goes on to say that eventually the universe will return again into a manifestation to another and another and another repetition of the whole process ad infinitum. It is important to remember, however, that the ancient teachers of these doctrines often described cosmological processes in terms of time simply for the sake of explanation, whereas they should actually be understood in terms of eternity. In this sense, eternity is not just everlasting time. Eternity is beyond time. It is now. The days and nights of Brahman are spread out in time, rather in the same way as a ball of thread, an inch in diameter, is unrolled to the length of 100 yards. Its real state resembles the ball, but to be presented to the human mind, it has to be unrolled. For our idea of time is spatial. It has length, which is a spatial dimension. But eternity has no length, and the nearest thing to it in our experience is what we call the present moment. It cannot be measured, but it is always here. The value of this Hindu idea becomes apparent when we think of it in this way. For it means that the far-off divine event is not just millions of years in the future, it is now. At this moment, the universe is both manifested as a collection of separate individual things, and at the same time, each of these things retains absolute unity and identity with its divine source. The object of Hindu, and for that matter, almost all Asian religion, is to awaken in man the realization of this unity and identity. In Hinduism, this realization is called moksha, or kaivalya, and in Buddhism, nirvana. And it is astonishing how seldom the West achieves any real understanding of what this condition of the spirit involves. The old 19th century idea that nirvana meant simply oblivion is now generally discredited. But some of the conceptions that have taken its place are almost as fantastic. Certain allowances for this misunderstanding must be made. For just as in the West there are mature and immature conceptions of Christianity, so in the East there are mature and immature conceptions of Hinduism and Buddhism. In fact, even some of the canonical scriptures of the East are just as overlaid with the interpolated comments of scribes as the Bible, even more so in the Buddhist scriptures. It is therefore quite common to find moksha or nirvana described as a type of trance condition in which all sense of the separate forms and objects of the universe has vanished, to be replaced by a state of infinite consciousness, into which the individual becomes absorbed, even though his physical body may continue to live on. If he ever returns out of this trance condition, it remains always at the back of his mind. The things around him seem like the insubstantial shadows of a dream. For life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity till death tramples it to fragments. At death, he merges his individuality forever into infinitude, unless he wishes to return again to the earth in order to teach Dharma, the law, to men. But one of the principal mistakes of Western interpretations of Asian thought is to equate Brahman with the infinite and the realization of one's identity with Brahman as a change from finite to infinite consciousness. It is well to remember the pertinent words of the Isa Upanishad. In darkness are they who worship the world alone, but in greatest darkness are they who worship the infinite alone. By a knowledge of the former, we are saved from death, and by a knowledge of the latter, we are preserved to immortality. The highest Hindu philosophy bears the name Advaita, which is the principle of non-duality, meaning that Brahman is that to which nothing can be opposed, as long is opposed to short, light to dark, pleasure to pain, positive to negative, and infinite to finite. This also is a cardinal principle of Mahayana Buddhism, from which it is clear that neither in Hinduism or Buddhism can it be said that the highest spiritual attainment is to become merged into any kind of infinitude. Man realizes his identity with Brahman. In other words, one cannot say that nirvana is infinite and not finite, or vice versa. Or even that it is a consciousness of unity and not diversity. Here again is an Asian conception, which is little understood in the West. For it is often thought that the supreme universal reality of Hinduism and Buddhism has the quality of oneness as distinct from manyness. And that realization is the knowledge that the forms and objects of the universe are in fact one, even though they appear to be many. Their seeming diversity is said to be an illusion, Maya, which the wise man will overcome. But this reality is not quite one in the sense we give to the word. To use a Vedantic expression, reality is one without a second. In the ordinary way, the idea of one immediately suggests the idea of many, or of none. For the moment you have the concept of nothing, you also have the concept of something. While in the same way you could not entertain the idea of many things without that of one thing. The reason for this is that the idea of oneness belongs to the multitudinous pairs of opposites, dvanda, of which life is composed. For one suggests many, just as long suggests short. The two concepts are mutually essential, and the one can only be known by means of the other. But Brahman, or reality, is beyond opposites, being that which does not require distinction for its existence. For Brahman is all things. This world we see around us, together with our consciousness and the thoughts in our minds and the feelings in our hearts. To see Brahman, we have just to look with our eyes. For Brahman is nothing other than that which we are beholding at this moment. So what? You ask. At the moment I am beholding a book. Is that anything to get excited about? Should I feel uplifted and spiritually enlightened just because this book is Brahman? I don't see anything divine and mighty about this collection of paper and printer's ink. In view of this, it will also be asked, what is the difference between a sage and an ordinary, ignorant man? We are accustomed to believe that a sage or mystic is one who beholds God or Brahman in all things. But if Brahman is all things, surely an ordinary man, in seeing them, is doing no less than the sage. This is perfectly true. But the difference between the sage and the ordinary man is that the latter fails to realize it. The reason is that because there is nothing apart from Brahman, Brahman cannot be seen in quite the ordinary way. To see things, we must be able to distinguish them, which means that we must be able to separate them from other things or from ourselves. But with Brahman, this cannot be done. For when you look at this book, Brahman is looking at Brahman. We have therefore to consider how the sage comes to understand this, and in what way this understanding is of practical value. Naturally, the sage does not understand it only conceptually. For him, it is not just an intellectual idea, as that space is curved. A mathematician may be able to prove in theory that space is curved, but cannot see it curved with his eyes, and thus the knowledge is for him purely conceptual and makes no difference to his ordinary behavior. He does not start to walk in curves, and unless he is absent-minded, in the way of some of his kind, he does not find it impossible to go from San Francisco to New York without going through Mexico City.